tonight on Arena. The Boffy Band meets Chuck Dowsa in Cork Aguina. We look at sounds from a safe harbour, and Paula Shields guides us through the May Gray Summer Collection. #51551 is the text number. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. I'm Rick O'Shea and I'm here with you till 8. Let's start with a new dance work harnessing the elemental forces of West Kerry and the raw energy of one of our most revolutionary music groups that'll be performed next month. 1975, Ní Déag Seacht Do Chúig will open at the brand new studio of Chuck Dowsa, which sits at the edge of the Atlantic Ocean. The dance work is set to the legendary 1975 album by the Boffy Band, now celebrating its half century. Before we hear from the choreographer of the work, Michael Keegan Dolan, let's have a little of 1975 with the Green Groves of Erin. That's my childhood in a nutshell right there, and I'm absolutely sure that my dad, who I know is listening at home tonight, will be thrilled with me. The Green Groves of Erin from the album 1975 by the Boffy Band. As I mentioned, choreographer Michael Keegan Dolan has set his new dance work to the album, and he joins us this evening from the RTE studio in Ballinagall in Cork Aguina in County Kerry. Michael, good evening.
Good evening.
We're listening to the fantastic sounds of the Boffy Band. I'm going to ask you in a moment about why their music is so central to your new work. But maybe first you'll tell us a little bit about what brought you to the West Kerry Gaeltacht and what that place means to you in terms of being an artist.
I think it's the best place in the world. I wanted to live in the best place in the world. So I had a look on Daft and I found a cottage up a mountain in Na Glaoithuí in the North Glens, and me and my wife Rochelle and our two children moved here about 8 years ago.
It's a fairly happening scene at the moment, if people still use that as a term these days, in terms of the artistic community that have come there in the last few years.
I think there was a lot of people living here for a long time preceding my arrival, and the new arrivals. I mean, the Begleys live here, or the O'Begliach, Cormac O'Begliach, who's someone I've worked with a little bit. He owns the B&B now, just up the road from our dance studio. And then just another house down, there's a painter from Cork, Aideen Glynn. So it's a happening place for sure.
Why this album, Michael? Why 1975? The Boffy
Well,
Band?
It's a bit like my first answer. I'm not trying to be funny, but I was trying to think, well, what's the best album ever? And that 1975 came into my mind as one of the front runners. I've worked a lot with music, really, since I started my training as an 18-year-old in the Central School of Ballet in London. And, you know, you work with Haydn and Handel and Mozart and Bartok and Stravinsky. But there's something about this album that is just kind of, it rises above them all in some ways for me. And like you, it connects me to my father and to my childhood, and to a time maybe that was very insecure in Ireland. This album represents a kind of a rebellion against the hardness and the difficulty of that time. And it somehow lifted us up, you know, and made us stand a little taller. So now that it's 50 years old, I felt I needed to kind of give homage to this thing that was made.
Okay, maybe tell us a little bit about the space itself. I presume there are huge benefits to having your own permanent dance rehearsal space and performance space as well, as opposed to travelling to different venues all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's the travelling is fatiguing. It kind of takes energy to move somewhere. And also when you arrive in a space, there's usually, you know, someone has just left before you and there's someone coming in after you. So having your own space means you can really settle and you can really consider everything, you know, the quality of the floor or the colour on the wall or the plant growing in the corner. And like, I'd be of a superstitious kind of a person. So I think everything in a room, in a space, where it's located, you know, what it's near, affects what happens in the space. So it used to be a factory. It was a building built and curated by the Uddaros na Gaeltacht. And about 8 years ago, someone showed me inside and So after a kind of a process of work and conversation, we've turned it, with the support of the Uddrus na Gaeltacht, into a dance studio. And it's in the most fabulous, fabulous location.
And maybe for those people who haven't had the chance to pass by yet, and obviously wouldn't have had a chance to have seen something in it yet, paint us a picture of the space itself that you have there.
Well, it's facing the Trúr de Fúracha, the Three Sisters. So there's kind of this endless light show, seasonal, daily changing array of colour and light. Certainly at this time of the year now, all the flowers in the hedgerows are in full bloom. The fuchsia, the montbretia, there's yellows and purples. The grass is long. There's beautiful cows just grazing, you know, right outside the door. And what's kind of amazing when you're in the space working is sometimes you can forget where you are because you're working. And then if you just walk out the door, you're surrounded by this elemental beauty. And sometimes we just go outside and kind of rehearse in the grass, or even actually sometimes in the field with the cows. And when you come back in, you bring something with you that you can never really find anywhere else. So the space itself was a factory. So it has a kind of a low ceiling. But even that we've turned to our advantage because it makes the space very, very focused and very good for sound and for good conversation. So you have to come and see it, Rick. You know, you have to come in the door and just hang out. It's a lovely place.
At this moment, Michael, I would like nothing more. often when we see dance performance, there's music involved, of course, but it tends to be live music usually.
Yeah.
Why did you choose recorded music in this particular instance, leaving aside the fact that it was the Bothy Band album?
Well, I mean, I've worked with live music for a very long time, and it's incredible. Like, because you not only hear the music, you really literally feel it in your bones and in your feet. And I've been doing that for a long time, and I felt like I needed a kind of a change or a transition. And there was something about having the focus being entirely on the dancers for once for a period of time. That would allow me the kind of focus that I wanted. I really wanted to hone in on how the dancers I'm working with move in some more detail. And I think the intimacy of our studio allows for that to be fully kind of explored. And then you see the great thing about an album, the grammar is restrictive. Like it had back in the day two sides. You know, it starts and it finishes. It's a bit like a really well-written play. I mean, you can deconstruct it or you can do it the way it was written. So I'm interested in the limitation that the album provokes. Like if a musician is in the room, you can say, hey, could you play that a little faster, a little slower? Mm. Or could you extend the middle section? Or could you repeat the B section there for me, please? But the album is the album. So I like being in that position.
And there's that other restriction. Maybe it's a restriction, maybe it's not, but that the album's music obviously lends itself to dance, but it's a very specific kind of dance. It's jigs and it's reels and it's quite a traditional form of Irish dance. So how do you work with that to create something new?
Well, I suppose I don't worry too much about making anything new. I try to make things that move people and that feel good for the practitioners, the dancers, to kind of embody. But like a reel is a 4-4 and a jig, you know, is a 6-8 and a waltz is a 3-4. So like rhythm is fundamental. And I think, you know, I mean, what is tradition, you know, and something that's been around a long time. But like, I suppose to answer your question more directly, like it's not difficult to make beautiful dances to this music. It's just such brilliant music, and the rhythms that are there are exquisite and they're beautifully held. Like the combination of musicians in that band were just, you know, exceptional masters, each of them in their own field.
Yeah, I was listening to the album in the car on the way in today, and it's been a very long time since I've heard it played in full. It still sounds incredibly sharp and incredibly new and incredibly forceful and almost modern.
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there's something lovely about like Tríd an Iogánaill singing her voice. It's kind of, it feels kind of powerful, doesn't it? This and the clavinet, and I suppose the clavinet as well, like brings me into that whole Sean O'Rea, the harpsichord, the harp, the baroque, you know, the pre and kind of Anglo-Saxon invasion of Ireland. And it's very, very provocative, the music. And like you mentioned, your father, like I remember my father going to see the Botty Band. Like I was 6 and he was 56 and now I'm 56. But like my dad didn't go and see traditional music because I think he was more into Yves Montand and Edith Piaf because he was a French speaker. But he went to see the Botty Band. And I remember noting that as a child going, what's so special about these guys, you know? So it's kind of lovely. It's lovely to be back there. But it doesn't feel nostalgic. Like it feels now and edgy and progressive and strange and wonderful.
Yeah, I'm not sure what my dad would have made of Yves Montand. I'll have a conversation with him about it. But definitely he would have seen the Botty Band and probably Planxty in places like the Embankment in Dublin and anywhere around whenever they were playing at that time. I'm going to play something else. Let me just take another song from the album really briefly. This is from 1975 by the Botty Band and it's The Butterfly. Well, that's genuinely fantastic. That is The Butterfly from 1975, the album by the Botty Band. Michael, are you hoping that Ní Dhéag Seacht Na Cúig connects with audiences maybe in some of the same ways that Irish traditional music does?
Oh, yes. I think connection, it's all about connection, making a connection and exploring that space and seeing what comes out the other end. Like, I suppose, you know, I bump into people down here who came to see Mom, maybe, and some of them might be making jokes about contemporary dance, you know, and what they perceive it to be or mean. But like, I feel like dancing is dancing, and it's when done well, both, you know, to dance in a ceilidh or in a set, but also to go watch a really beautiful, deep, you know, virtuoso dancer. Like, it's a very deep experience. And I suppose we're reaching towards that. Like we have this fantastic album, and I've brought 5, you know, extraordinary dancers here to work with me. So we're going to try to make something exceptionally beautiful and moving.
And as I understand it, there won't be a linear story to this necessarily,
no,
but the dancers, they're going to relate some stories. There will be some narrative in it. Is that how it's going to work?
Well, I don't, yeah. I mean, the thing about being an artist is you'd never really know how it's going to work. Because, I mean, if you do, you're probably not an artist. So we're kind of, at the moment, we're working our way through it. But like, I think there's 14 tracks on the album, but there's 27 tunes, and each of the tunes is named after someone or something or somewhere. Mm. So like even within that, there are 27 stories multiplied by 27 multiplied by 27. And like when you hear something like The Butterfly, that's one thing going on with your consciousness. But then when you're watching beings move in space, you know, in time, in rhythm, paying great attention to one another, another thing starts to happen to your consciousness. So it, you don't really know what you're doing, but you apply everything you know as best you can to what's going on.
Now, I hate to be that person, but having excited people about the possibility of getting to witness this, I understand there's not an awful lot of tickets left. Is that true?
No, there's not a lot of tickets left. So one day I was walking along and, you know, we've toured a lot internationally, endlessly. And then we've been gifted this incredible studio. So then I just thought, like, what can we do? So what we should do is make a show for the studio, only for the studio, that kind of celebrates that relationship, and that so that people around the studio who live near it can walk up to it and come in and see what we're doing and kind of maybe form a connection to that. Now, if it grows arms and legs and wings next year or the year after, that's fine. Maybe we'll bring it somewhere else. But for now, it's only in our studio, and we have 75 seats, and we're doing 10 performances.
It sounds genuinely incredible. I wish you nothing but luck with it. Michael Keegan-Dolan, choreographer and founder of Teoch Dowsa, thanks for joining us this evening from the RTE studio in Ballynagyle in County Kerry. The new dance work, 1975, Ní Déag Seacht Do Chuaigh, will be performed at Teoch Dowsa on Glashevyog in Corcaguina in County Kerry from August 27th to September 7th. You'll find all of the details and the handful of tickets that are left at teochdowsa.com. That's TEACDAMSA. I'll spell it for you, .com. To end, we're going to hear another track from 1975 by the Bothy Band. This is Do You Love an Apple, sung by one of the band's founder members, the incredible Trina Ní Gonal. That is the Bothy Band from 1975, an album that celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, and vocals by Trina Ní Gonal. We'll take a break and we're back with Sounds from a Safe Harbour. Sounds from a Safe Harbour celebrates 10 years of running events in Cork City, and this year the festival welcomes artists like Will Butler, Beth Orton, Lisa Hannigan, Soak and Junior Brother, who was in this studio just last week. The film programme has also been announced, including Steve, produced by and starring Cillian Murphy, Train Dreams, scored by Bryce Desner of The National, and a new documentary about Donal Lunny called In Time. Sounds from a Safe Harbour director Mary Hickson joins me tonight from our Cork studio, and Shannon-based rap artist God Knows, who's playing at the festival, is in our Limerick studio. It's great to have you both with us this evening. Mary, I'm going to start with you. Maybe you'll tell me a little bit about the genesis of Sounds from a Safe Harbour 10 years ago and how it starts with a meeting with Bryce Desner from The National. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's right. I was doing a festival. I'll have to go back a step if that's okay. But in 2011, when I was running Cork Opera House, I was doing a festival to celebrate Steve Reich's 75th birthday. And I slid into Bryce Desner's DMs on Facebook to see if he would be around and available to participate. And to my surprise, he responded to say, sadly, he wasn't available, but that he would be in touch if and when he was ever in Cork. And sure, I was like, I'm never going to hear from this guy. But in 2013, The National played the Marquee in Cork. And sure enough, Bryce Desner popped into my inbox and I literally let out a yelp down the corridor in the Opera House, and he asked if I'd like to meet for a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. Went up to the Hayfield Manor, and 2 hours later we decided we were making a festival together in 2015, 2 years later, which became the first Sounds from a Safe Harbour. And it was only ever intended to be a one-off. It was part of my kind of swan song. I had a 5-year tenure in the Opera House and I wanted to go out with a splash. And Bryce and I made Sounds from a Safe Harbour together then, and we had such a good time that we decided we would repeat it every other year. And there's something nice about that 2-year cycle where you can put it away, let it go fallow, like forget about it for a while and pick it up and go at it then. So that was the first one. It was just Bryce and I.
And you're right, there's less of that hectic nature of feeling like you're constantly on a treadmill year after year after year. You're going to have to explain the 37D03D.
Okay, so if you write people...
Residency?
Yeah, write people in caps and turn it upside down.
That was explained to me earlier. I had to
37D03D. The reason we had to turn it upside down is we started this residency idea in Berlin in 2016, which retrospectively became called People. It was given the title after the event because we created this environment where people were like exploring new ideas. Same ideas like Michael Keegan-Dolan was just talking about, like making connections, exploring ideas, seeing what comes out of a process together. No hierarchy, everyone's treated the same. And it was Eric Timothy Carlson, who's an artist based in New York. He was kind of wandering around trying to find, searching for what is the name of this thing. And he's like, it's just people, peopling together. It's people. And we created this banner, a 20 meter long banner, and just hung it and just said the word people. After that, we got a cease and desist from Time Warner on the word, which is kind of hilarious. So we just turned it upside down. We're like, hang on a second, 37D, 37 degrees, human body temperature. It's nice. So we're like, let's just be people upside down. So
because of the magazine title, that is just clicking with me there.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
I mean, it's kind of, in a weird way, a compliment that we're on their radar and they sent us a rap on the knuckles. But look, yeah, we kind of like the fact that we're upside down people. We're kind of trying to do things a little different. Yeah, that's where 370 O3D comes from.
And in terms of Sounds from a Safe Harbor, introduce me to your other curators, the core group of people who are involved in putting it together.
So for this particular iteration, Bryce has stayed with me for all the five editions. There was one offline edition, which wasn't really a real festival. But so for the four, it's been myself and Bryce. And this iteration, it's with Killian Murphy, Max Porter, the writer, and Billy McGlynn, folklorist. And each of them play a very kind of very core, pivotal role in the kind of devising of what this festival looks and feels like and what our kind of core intentions are. So, yeah, we've been working on the programme, I would say, for over a year together, like who slowly kind of building out the residency, which is a very important part of what we do. Like, we're a residency-based festival, and by that I mean we're inviting up to 80 artists to come and spend time together for the week and make new work and, like, experiment and try new things and fail and hang out for the week. So much of what we will present at the weekend, we don't know yet.
Your friendship with Killian Murphy goes back a long way, as I understand mm-hmm. it. When did the two of you start to collaborate together, though?
So our parents were friends, so we kind of were around each other. I wouldn't say we were friends growing up, but like we would have been in rooms together. And then when we were both in college, I was pulling pints in the Half Moon, and his band Sons of Mr. Green Jeans would have been playing on stage. So again, we shared space and we're like hanging out, but I wouldn't say that we were like, you know, best buddies or anything back at the time. But again, the same year that I Facebooked Bryce Dessner while I was at the Opera House, we presented Ballyturk and Welch's play that Killian was in. I don't know, it's just something about us in that time and that moment. We just kind of fused again, and we've been fast friends ever since, very close.
I'm interested in the nature of the curation of the festival, because mm-hmm. it's something I've done before, but from the outside, looking at this and the nature of what a real-time project this is, mm-hmm. because you put artists together in spaces all around the city, mm-hmm. and you're curating and producing as you go in real time. How does that work?
Much of the work is happening right now and has been happening for months. So we're exchanging. I could be flying like hundreds of emails every day, like connecting artists with each other and proposing things. And, you know, like for today, for example, I wrote to a bunch of artists asking if they'd like to play drums at the opening ritual. We're very fortunate to have one of the dancers that's working with Michael on the 1975 coming to be part of that event as well, Jimmy Southward. So you're just making those connections, and slowly every single element, every single event starts to kind of grow and take shape. Like, for the most part, we don't show, or the way in which we show work is very unique to Sounds from a Safe Harbour. So you won't see anything that you've seen before. Like every event is going to be embellished in some which way.
Hmm. God knows you're in our Limerick studio. I want to bring you in here. You're playing Sounds from a Safe Harbour this year, but you've had experience in previous years of the residency. So from the inside, maybe from the artist's perspective, how does it operate?
So from my perspective, I mean, I say to anybody who will listen to me that being part of people, which, you know, once you're in, you're like, I'm in, bro. I'm people for life, because that changed the way that I create. Everything Mary just said is the way that I create music today, and I try to keep and I try to leave my friends who I meet on this journey of creating with that spirit. You know that, you know, a little bit of people is with me every time that I'm in the studio with anybody. So from an artist's perspective, it really opens you up to knowing that if you let your ego get in the way of doing music, you will not have a great time. It won't be that much fun. And for me, being part of Sounds from the Safe Harbor and also being in Berlin, those two experiences just changed the way that I create music, but also it enriched, you know, what can I say? Like, it enlarged my tent, if I can even say. You know, I never knew that you could go that far with, and that big and that wide, and that you can dream. Like, I'm already a dreamer, but that just, yeah, it opened my eyes in a very, very good way.
Do you remember your first experience with the People Collective, how they explained the idea and how that worked for you at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I had no expectations yet, no limitations. So I was in a very good position to enjoy myself because I came in just ready, you know. And I have to say, man, it was incredible because you're around all the musicians that, in terms of the way that I want my career to go, I was in the room with everybody who is going in a direction that I want to, by the grace of God, end up in. And they are great human beings. It just, I don't know, man, it just made me believe in humanity that little bit more.
Mary, can you explain, if you're a punter and you're coming to Sounds from a Safe Harbour for the first time, what is that like as somebody who's there just to experience and for people who've maybe never been before?
We're definitely a different kind of festival offering, and in the way that, like, we're inviting artists to come and explore new things, try new things, collaborate with each other. We're also asking the audience to come with an open mind. Like, they might think they're coming to see John Hopkins or Ben Howard, but we'd really like them to have a new experience. And we know too that their experience of either, if it is John Hopkins or Ben Howard, is going to be unique. So they will leave, whether they like it or not, they'll leave with the new experience anyway. But we announce a certain amount of what we're doing. Because of the nature of the residency, we really genuinely don't know what's going to happen. So what we might end up putting on stages, and much of that will be populating like a free secret pop-up program that'll be all over the city, because we have over 80 artists. We're going to have, you know, we'll have at least 50 free pop-up events. We don't know what they're going to be either. So keep an eye on our social media. We're also trying as best we can to get people off their phones when they're in rooms. So we're going to be creating a festival zine. So I would say to the audience too, to like, make sure you get your hands on the zine, because all the secrets and the treasure hunts and the, like, we're really leaning into the notion of play and, like, just like dive in, explore, curate your own experience to a point, but also like, if you hear a secret of something happening around the corner, like, just check it out.
Just go with it. What I would say is just go with it.
Yeah.
And you do not want to miss this. This is,
I mean, honestly, anything can happen. Like, in the past, like, stuff that's gone down is kind of, it's incredible. Like,
it's
Matt
magical.
Berninger singing Cat Power in a small pub, like that kind of stuff happens.
I love the idea of when I heard about the zine, the idea of, it's the sort of thing that doesn't really happen at festivals anymore. It's the sort of thing that everybody expects to have detailed listings and they're on your website or they're on an app.
Yeah.
And this kind of completely turns that expectation on its head.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a mural as well, and like, each of the zines are going to be part of this big treasure hunt. Like, we want the idea of play and like game and chance to be a big feature, like, to the point where, like, I've gotten in way too deep on this. There's 52 musicians on the residency. I've made a deck of cards, for real. We've made a deck of cards, and we're going to be like heroing this old card game in Cork called Don. We're going to have a Don tournament, but you'll play them with the Sounds from a Safe Harbour deck.
Oh, this sounds perfectly reasonable to me.
Totally reasonable, right? And each day you'll be identified by a suit, and like, there's going to be secrets around the place with like little treasure hunts where you need to kind of know your Cork local knowledge to be able to decipher the codes and figure out where this secret event's going to happen. So that kind of forces you to speak to a local if you're not from here. So it's all about like, just, yeah, don't just be physically on the ground, like, make connections.
God knows you were talking about it a little, but tell me about how being part of the People Experience and part of Sounds from a Safe Harbour, how that's changed the way you work as an artist.
Oh, for sure. I'm with Merle as well in the room, Mary, just in case. It changed the way we create. I mean, Merle always is more articulate on the studio side of things, but just more so everything that Mary has said in terms of the festival and the performance side, but there's also a studio side as well, where you're in the room with an artist that in another way, they have their own band. But in that moment, we are just two dudes in a room and we have a song to make. And because we all, I believe the way as a musician, I go into the studio with a childlike wonder every time. Every single time I walk into a room to make a song, I am a child and I'm ready to explore and go as far, and I'm ready to be molded and shaped to make whatever the best art is in that moment. And I am not, God knows, from Rusangano. I'm not, God knows, from Narrow Lane. I am literally Munya in a room with Bryce, and we're going to create this tune.
Yeah,
and who knows what the tune is going to be. If this tune requires me to just clap my hands and that's all I'm doing, I'm clapping my hands.
I mean, it is. It's exactly that. Like, leave your ego at the door. It's like there's a huge amount of trust both in me and each other.
Absolutely.
And I might suggest, like, hey, G, do you want to get in the room? Like you just said there, hypothetically, right? Do you want to get in the room with Bryce for an hour and just see what happens? Sometimes that fuses in the right way. It ignites something. Sometimes it fails, and that the failure part, like we create space for that too. That's really important. But more often than not, like for example, Monday at Sounds from Safe Harbor 2023, at the beginning of the residency, Oliver Arnolds and Owen French went into a room together. And like the absolute magic that was created, like we felt it all week. It was like we'd no idea what was coming, but this art was just bursting out of the room. And they would call me in every couple of hours, and I'd sit on the floor, and they'd be like, "Look what just happened today!" And you're like, "Gee, Mac." It's incredible when it works. It's just like, it's like, you know what it's like when everyone's going home? It's like Irish college. Do you remember when you went to Irish college and everyone's in bits because they're leaving and they're going to miss each other so much, and they're all signing each other's jumper? Like, it's that crack, you know? But like Monday, Tuesday, there's a bit of hesitancy, a bit of like imposter syndrome. People are, oh, I don't know, should I really be here? And by Wednesday, they're rocking and rolling, and it's just like pouring out of everybody.
Like, let me tell you, Mary was literally like, gee, do you want to go in that one? Go in that room there and make a song with them. All right, yeah, Merle, you go in that one there. You do that. Hey, John, you do that one over there. And then by the end of the week in Berlin, we made 23 songs.
Yeah.
Like literally from my album that's coming out, shameless plug, on the 26th of September.
I was going to ask, don't worry, I was way ahead of you.
On my album that's coming out on the 26th of September, I made 70-something songs. And that comes from the idea that, okay, Merle said, I should jump on this rhythm and we're going to do this. And just now I can create quickly because I don't have anxiety to jump into any room at any time, anywhere, any country, any place, because that week I collaborated with High Up and Low Down, different styles, different worlds, different musicality, different tones. I just was going for it because, hey, Mary said, this is what we're doing. This is what we're doing. Like, just to give you a scene, let me paint a scene. It's all good. Let me paint you a scene. So we walk into the Michelberger Hotel in Berlin. It's the coolest thing ever. We walk into this place. It's as magical, like Alice in Wonderland kind of vibes. You walk in there, and then Macaulay Culkin is right there chilling with his bunny ears, and it's like, oh, snap, bro. There's Richie Rich. Bless. Big up Richie Rich. Walk past Richie Rich. Go up there. Mary's in there. She's like, hey, guys, so before you guys go put your bags down, just in that basement over there, Justin Vernon, Boys Noise, and Francis and the Lights are making beats. Go and check them out. If in my world, that is some of my favorite producers in the world. They're all making beats together. We get down there. Mind you, we just arrived to this place.
And Mary has just pointed you in a direction and gone, that's it, you're going here.
Hey, I'm still shocked. I'm still shocked that Macaulay Culkin is right there. Okay?
Just walk past him. Yeah.
And look, I'm sure there's a lot more of those stories. I'm going to play something from you, God knows. But thank you, Mary Hickson. And thank you, God knows.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Sounds from a Safe Harbour takes place from the 11th to the 14th of September in venues around Cork City. Soundsfromasafeharbour.com is the website. The latest single from God knows is called Misplaced Empathy. And that's hocus pocus. I can give you my heart, I can't give you my soul. I'm a man of God, I don't do what I'm told. Had to get a new lens, cause I was losing focus. I'm here and I'm gone, and that's hocus pocus. Straight onto my Spotify playlist, God knows Misplaced Empathy here on Arena. We're back in a second talking about Maigret. Inspector Jules Maigret is one of the most popular and enduring fictional detectives of the 20th century, working out of the police HQ at 36 Quai des Orfèvres in Paris. He is devoted to justice, his wife, good food, and of course, alcohol. From 1931 to 1972, Maigret appeared in 75 novels by Georges Simenon, a writer who couldn't have been less like his creation, a man who lived lavishly and who claimed to have had 10,000 lovers, including the celebrated singer and dancer Josephine Baker. Now, Penguin Publishing House has reissued 12 mysteries this week in what they call the Maigret Summer Collection, with new front covers and recent translations. The titles, including The Carter of La Providence, Maigret's Dead Man, and Maigret's Holiday. Paula Shields has been looking at all things Maigret and Simenon first, and she joins me now in studio. But like many fictional detectives, Paula, he's been adapted for TV, he's been played on screen by Rowan Atkinson, I think I missed that one, and Michael Gambon. We're going to hear Gambon in action first in Maigret's Patience, one of the dozen stories reissued in this new collection.
Can you guess what happened today? Someone else was telling me to retire.
Monsieur Cormelio?
Oh, no. He'd love to see the back of me, but he's too polite to say so. No, it was somebody else. A professional gangster.
Really?
And it's very odd. I mean, here we have Monsieur Cormelio, the examining magistrate, a man of high breeding, a pillar of integrity. And I can't stand the man. And then we have Palmari, gangster and pimp. Probably a murderer, too, even though it's second hand. I quite like him.
Certainly an interesting idea.
What is?
We could have a little cottage on the Loire. With a garden and an orchard. I can see you in your old clothes, smoking your pipe, tending your garden, while I'm in the kitchen preparing lunch. Something miraculous with aubergines, I think.
What are you talking about?
Our retirement. It sounds lovely, don't you think so?
I think it sounds extraordinarily tedious.
That's Maigret and his wife having lunch discussing his possible retirement, something he's obviously not keen on. Michael Gambon as Maigret and Ciarán Madden as Madame Maigret from Maigret's Patience, filmed for Granada TV in 1992. Paula, why is he so appealing even now?
I think there are many reasons. You can hear, I think one of his superpowers is Madame Maigret, I have to say, although I would say that. He's in quite a bleak world. He doesn't believe in evil, but he does believe that ordinary humans are capable of terrible things, and he sees this every day. But to balance that, we have Madame Maigret, who is permanently cooking. I mean, I'd like a wife like Madame Maigret. So they have this fantastic relationship that's quite low-key, but she's definitely his equal. And then there's his take on things. Maigret is a detective that brings you into the world with him. I mean, I love Sherlock Holmes, but we admire Sherlock from afar. Whereas with Maigret, you're in his head, it's his point of view, you're with him on the beat. And you hear there, what we've seen just before this lunch is Maigret's had an encounter with this criminal, Palmari, who he does like. You know, he's prepared to have his quirky take on things.
We're here to talk about the books, and thank you very much for loaning me Maigret's Holiday, which we are going to talk about later. I started reading it last night, and then 50 pages later, I had to pluck myself and go to bed. The books in this collection are all fairly short, sub 200 pages. They're all written in a kind of very spare style. Is that typical of Maigret as a whole?
It is. Georges Simenon was a prolific writer, but the books tend to veer between 150 pages, 200 pages, but he can pack a lot into those few pages. You know, the writing is spare and beautiful, and he doesn't use many adverbs or adjectives, but he can paint a scene in a handful of words. As he was born in Belgium, but as a young man, he came to Paris and he was a journalist, and he sent off short stories to Colette, the famous French writer. And she kept rejecting them, telling him he was too literary. So famously, when he did edit, he would write these books in a week and then he would edit for 2 days. All he edited for was style, not mistakes. So he would cut extraneous words from them. But as I said, he draws you into characters and setups. You're always looking at societies, and he's very interested in class. So the idea that they're short, they're still a very rich read.
He was famously prolific, and Maigret was far from the only character that he wrote about.
Yes. He had success early with Maigret, and then he thought in the 30s, I think about 1934, 3 years after the first books came out, that he'd retire him. And he wrote a series of what are called the roman dur, the hard novels. And some of those books like Dirty Snow really are seen as the masterpieces. But of course, they didn't sell as well as Everybody Loved Maigret. Why wouldn't you like a warm, funny, wry detective? So he went back to those. He'd also, in his youth, I think he wrote his first novel at 18, but he'd written a lot of potboilers and pulp fiction. And so the exact figure isn't known, but it's thought that he wrote in his lifetime something like 425 books in all. And, you know, he was born in 1903, died in 1989. So, you know, he packed them in.
It's interesting because he was very different from Maigret himself, Simenon, in that Maigret liked to live a relatively speaking sparse life once he had a glass of wine and a mystery to solve. Simenon seemed to like the high life.
He did. He lived in, I think, 33 different addresses in his lifetime, but he drove expensive cars. He lived in big houses. He lived in a chateau at one point. So he did like to earn well. And as we say, you know, the 10,000 lovers claim his second.
That came from him, presumably.
It did. And his second estranged wife dissed that claim by saying, no, he only had 1,200 lovers. Now, how he had time for any of them, because he obviously worked quite hard as well, I'm not sure. But there's Maigret with the faithful wife and lives for the work, really. Madame Maigret can be forgotten in some of these mysteries as well, when he's honing in on villains and he's getting interested in all kinds of characters. But they couldn't have been more different in many ways.
Maybe he's just a good multitasker. I like the idea that he would famously go to his doctor for a checkup before he started a new novel. Why was that?
Because he felt a novel coming on like an illness, like a migraine. So he would have an idea and it would build and build, and then he would know he had to write it. And his way of working was he had to write in one burst. And so he would go to the doctor to make sure he was well enough to sustain this. Because if he got ill mid, you know, on day four or something, he would have to abandon that novel and start again. So he would go and get checked out, and then he would get the all clear, and then he would come. But he would write for maybe 8 or 9 days in a row, and sometimes physically get sick at the end of it, like physically throw up. And like I say, then there'd be 2 days of an edit, and then bang, it's gone, it's over.
Did he base Maigret on anybody in particular?
A few people. It's said that his father had a very pleasant temperament. So the whole idea of Maigret's patience, the way he's got time, he's in no rush, that was built on his own father. He was also very friendly with a famous police inspector of the time, Marcel Guillaume, and he was said to have lent Maigret some of his characteristics. And I think they did share, I think Simenon and Maigret, the one thing they did share was the liking for a drink.
These reissues are lovely. They're really well presented. The covers are very beautiful. You chose to read Maigret's Holiday out of the 12 ones that have been brought out in this summer collection. Tell us a little bit about Maigret's Holiday. I'm only 40 pages in, no spoilers.
Okay, noted. I picked Maigret's Holiday because we're in holiday season now, and of course, it isn't a real holiday for Maigret. They go off to the seaside. It's a town just north of La Rochelle on the western coast. And by the time the book starts, Madame Maigret is taken ill. She's in a hospital, leaves Maigret a lot of free time to fill. Someone slips him a note to say, check out the patient in room 15. And before he can do anything about it the next morning, said patient, a young woman called Lily, is found dead. And from there, we're into it's an almost gothic setup. There's a Dr. Bellamy who's equal in status to Meg Ray, and there's a lot of battle of wills between them. And this woman who's died is the sister, the younger sister of his wife, this mysterious, beautiful Odette, who we don't really see much of until much later than you've read into the book. But Meg Ray's on holiday. He's there in an unofficial role, and yet he's a famous detective from Paris. So one of the things I like about these books is it reminds you that, you know, this book came out in 1948. He's famous because he's been photographed in all the newspapers. It isn't even TV famous at that stage. And there's a lot of appeal. You know, there's a lot of humour in the books as well. He has to visit his wife at 3 o'clock every day. The hospital is run by nuns. He finds himself really irritated. And he says early on, he's turning into a choir boy in front of them, in spite of, you know, he's this very famous, well-established detective.
He has to turn his head away because of the Calvados that's on his breath that he's had after his lunch. You wouldn't want the nuns to find out about that.
He seems to drink with impunity. I mean, there's nothing macho about him. That's all lightly dealt with. I suppose we're looking at it with 21st century eyes, but I'm thinking it's 9 a.m. and he's on a second glass of white wine. And, you know, I wish I had that staying power.
They're small glasses of white wine, though. He's very specific about that.
That must be the case. That must be the case. But it's quite funny because we still believe him. You know, he doesn't seem to, you know, get impaired, shall we say, in terms of how he's reading people or dealing with situations.
The other maybe strange element of this story is that World War II doesn't really get a mention, even though he gives a close portrait of the society at the time. The novel's published 3 years after the war, but you might not necessarily know that.
No, it's an oddity. A couple of the Roman d'Or are set in World War II. Dirty Snow is set in German-occupied France, but he tends to nod to them obliquely rather than mention the war. And he went on writing books during World War II, and he moved from Paris to the French countryside, and he got in trouble after the Second World War he was accused of collaboration, and he was arrested briefly and investigated. And I think the worst thing that he did was he did sell the rights to some of his novels to a Nazi film company, which isn't great.
It's not
allegedly
a good look.
It's not a good look. But there are moments, there's a novel, I can't remember the exact title, but he talks about Madame Maigret is away looking after her sister in Alsace, and he moves into a lodging house in Paris. It's partly due to the case he's working on. And he says there are 6 houses in a row and 5 of them have widows. And we know as the reader why 1951, say, in Paris, there would be a lot of widows.
So it sounds like you would recommend both this and maybe the people's exploration of the group of novels as a whole?
Totally. I was thinking, listening to Mary Hickson there, and God knows from Sounds of a Safe Harbour, Penguin have given us a kind of festival here. You know, they're portable if you want to stick them in your suitcase. I still prefer books over Kindles and all the rest. Simenon's a brilliant writer. He's a brilliant writer. So you'll be drawn in as you were last night, Rick.
And as I hope to continue to be, Paula Shields, thank you so much for talking to us about the Meg Ray collection, the summer collection, including Meg Ray's Holiday, Meg Ray in Vichy. Interesting. And Meg Ray's Patients are out now and they're published by Penguin. That's it from us for tonight. The show is produced by Deirdre Neilane. Research is by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Broadcast coordinators Ollie Hamilton, and our sound supervision tonight by Niall McMonagall. I'm Rick O'Shea and I will talk to you tomorrow night here on RTE Radio 1 from 7 o'clock. John Creedence next.